Welcome to another edition of Big Blue Kickoff Live right here on Giants.com. The phone number for you is 201-939-4513. We'll be talking to this guy, Lance Meadow, and this guy, that's me, John Schmelk, about everything Giants football. And we're going to start our series of interviews with people that cover the college programs of some of the top prospects in the NFL draft. We'll start today with USC and Scott Schrader, who will be with us in just a minute or so. But a lot of stuff to talk about today. We spoke a lot about the owners' meetings yesterday in terms of what Pat Shurmur said in the morning. Right after the show ended, or as the show ended, Dave Gettleman was speaking to the media, so we can touch on those comments. Then John Mara spoke later in the day, and we had a bunch of rules changes announced as well. So Lance, a lot going on right now in the National Football League.
Absolutely. I mean, in terms of what Dave Gettleman and John Mara then said, I mean, I think that Gettleman made it clear, Mara maybe more so, that right now he is not on the trade block, Odell Beckham. And as far as the conversation is concerned, it's all speculation, all rumorville, which pretty much was the assumption and the storyline on Monday, so I don't think anything drastically changed. And Dave Gettleman also made it very clear that he does not address contractual negotiations with players, which is nothing new. That's been Giants policy forever. And when the reporters were pressing him on the issue, he stuck to the fact that you don't quit on talent, which was a notable line that he utilized, John, in his introductory presser.
Correct.
About guys getting clean slates, and also if there were any prior issues, you also need to take into consideration how talented the player is, which I also don't think is a stretch.
No question about it, and we'll talk about that. And then, of course, the NFL rule changes. Roger Goodell will be addressing the media down in Orlando shortly as well. So we'll touch on all that, but not until after our guest. And that's Scott Schrader, the head analyst for TrojanInsider.com, covers the USC football Trojan. Scott, you got John Schmelk and Lance Meadow here in New York City. How are you?
Great. Thank you. How you guys doing?
We're doing great, Scott. Thanks a lot for being with us today. And we'll start with the guy that most believe will be the top overall pick, but I know some Giant fans might be hoping he drops to number two to give the Giants a chance to pick him. And that's Sam Darnold. Watching his two-year career at USC, if you were to create two boxes, the good and the bad, what would you put in both boxes for Darnold?
Well, the good, you have a guy who's obviously extremely talented, a guy that can make all the throws, but on top of that, a guy who has it's exceptional mobility. That's just, you know, kind of the football side. He has all the talent, but there are some issues with ball security and some decision making. And, you know, Sam was more than willing to try and throw the ball into tight windows and stuff like that. So, you know, there's so many positives, but the negative part, we never really focused a whole lot about that. But the thing that stood out to me the most was the ball security issues. And Jordan Palmer was at USC Pro Day, and he's Darnold's quarterbacks coach, and he was talking about how they spent the last couple of months working on that part of his game. And another part that seems to be a question with some NFL clubs is that Sam seems to be really quiet and reserved, whereas I love the way Palmer put it with Darnold is that he's not looking for a date. He's looking to get married. So once you get to know somebody like Sam, he is actually maybe one of my favorite players that I've had an opportunity to cover in the 17 years I've been doing USC.
Well, Scott, as you mentioned, I mean, ball security has been a big topic of discussion with Darnold. And, I mean, I'm looking at the numbers, 13 interceptions, 11 fumbles during his sophomore season. You mentioned he likes to throw into tight windows. As far as the fumbles is concerned, I think of the 11, he lost 9. What stands out to you as to why he had problems in terms of holding on to the football?
You know, when it was happening, it was hard to figure out some of why some of it happened, because there were times where he wasn't even touched and the ball would come out of his hands. And again, I'll fall back onto Jordan Palmer, who is his quarterback's coach. It's that Sam tended to just hold on to the ball with one hand at all times. So they've worked on him trying to now, apparently the last couple of months he spent most days holding onto the ball with his left hand. So they believe that will solve that problem. I don't know. I'm not a quarterback's coach, but as far as the fumbles, it seemed like he wasn't holding onto the ball securely enough.
How about in terms of the interceptions and the decision-making? I realize, like you said, he anticipates, he throws into tight windows, things of that nature. How many of those interceptions were simply bad decisions, not seeing the defense? How many were him trying to make something happen when the team was down? How much context is there regarding the number of interceptions he threw last year?
I do believe that last year, as far as the pass protection that he got from the offensive line at times was questionable. So he definitely, there were times where he was definitely trying to make something happen. There were at least three or four interceptions that I recall that were almost as good as punts. You know, just figured that they might as well, they were maybe on the 45, 50 yard line, and he just figured, what the heck, just throw it up.
Right.
But there were also some issues, and one that stands out because it was the last one was in the Cotton Bowl where USC was on their own 10-yard line and Darnold threw a pick six and they were trying to figure out, you know, was so those are one of those throws where I don't know whether that was a wrong route, you know, whether the communication with the receiver wasn't there.
Right.
But there were plenty of those type of interceptions as well.
Scott, there's a lot of comparisons, obviously, between all of these quarterbacks because there are so many that are projected to go in the first round. And considering you've been covering USC, I'm sure you have familiarity with Josh Rosen at UCLA, and he played against Darnold and USC this season. You know, from your perspective, you know, what stands out to you in terms of the difference between Darnold versus Rosen, considering both of those guys are expected to go within the top five?
Well, the biggest difference that stands out for me is Sam seems to be more mobile, and not that the Josh is also an exceptional athlete as well. I mean, Josh is one of those guys that can tuck the ball and run too. I think right now Rosen is, and people will throw out statistics and whatnot, say that they both completed the same number of passes. I don't know about all that stuff. I think right now that Josh Rosen is a better pure passer right now. And it just Sam just seems like Sam can make plays happen that Josh Rosen can't.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think two other nitpicks I've heard, Scott, and we're joined by Scott Schrader, TrojanInsider.com. He's their head analyst. And I realize you're not a quarterbacks coach, so if this is too technical, I apologize ahead of time. One is his quote-unquote long release, which I watch him. I don't see that as a big issue because I've seen him tighten it up a little bit. But the other one that's not mentioned quite as much, but I think might impact his accuracy sometimes a little bit, is some people think he might have the tendency to kind of step in the bucket a little bit and open his hips too much when he throws. Has that been a talk around his pro day from Jordan Palmer about some of the stuff they're trying to work with him on?
I didn't – that part of it, I didn't – Jordan did spend quite a bit of time answering questions. And you know, I was trying to run around and
of course.
Try and catch everybody on pro day. And I didn't get to hear everything that Jordan says. But that is a topic that I have heard come up. And with me not also being a quarterback's coach, that's the kind of stuff I'm not really that in tune with. But – there were a number of issues that were kind of striking and standing out that they wanted to work on during the couple of months after the season ended. And whether that was one of them or not, I don't know. I know that ball security was the first one. That said, Sam came out for that pro day, and you know you're not lining up against anybody, but whatever he's worked on over the last couple of months, he came out looking as good as I've seen him since following him from San Clemente High School to USC. So I'm sure there are plenty of issues that he needs to work on. You know, he was only the starting quarterback at USC for a little more than a year and a half. And, you know, I think Clay Helton put it best that the best is still yet, you know, to come for Sam Donald. There's still plenty for him to work on, and I'm sure there are for all quarterbacks.
Well, Scott, I think that's apparent. And also, aside from the mechanical and technical issues of a quarterback, it's also about whether or not you can command the huddle and earn the respect of your teammates. What has his interaction been like with his teammates, and how much do you see the other guys feeding off of what he brings to the team?
You know, with some of the interceptions that happened last year and the fumbles, you know, there were times where we were questioning what was going on with Sam. And this is the biggest example for how much support he had with his teammates, how important he was to his teammates, is that they almost took offense any time you questioned anything that was happening with Sam. And they knew how important he was to that football team and to them as men. And the support that he had, the way he was in the huddle, just exuded to everybody on the offense. And it even carried over to the defense. He was a guy that came in right away, and you know, you go from being well-liked to just being admired by his teammates. So that part is probably, it could be one of his biggest strengths. So you know, that's probably all I can, I probably can't add much more than that.
Yeah, absolutely, and I've heard the same thing from talking to people that were around the program. I want to swap over to Ronald Jones here for a second, and you know, when the season's over, so much attention is paid to the quote-unquote post-season draft process, where it's everything except for actually what matters the most, the pads, what happens in the games that people get obsessed about. And Ronald Jones has been noticeably absent from that post-draft process because of a hamstring injury. He tried to run at the combine, couldn't really do it. He was limited at the USC Pro Day. Do you think that's bothering him, and is he really trying hard to get that hamstring good enough to show these scouts something in the, you know, pre-draft season? Or do you think he's pretty comfortable sitting on what he did during the season and having that be enough for scouts to look at?
No, I don't think that he's comfortable with that. And in fact, I don't know what date or where they're going to be doing it, but wide receiver Deonte Burnett and Ronald Jones have another day planned to where they're going to work out for NFL scouts. So I know that he's not comfortable with that. He wants to work out in front of the guys to improve his draft status. And you know, he's working with a guy, Lee Steinberg, who knows this draft process as good as anybody. So yeah, so he plans on working out in front of the guys, but to answer your question, he's definitely not comfortable with not working out in front of the guys.
So the thought is that the hamstring will heal quickly enough for him to do something in the next 2 or 3 weeks to get in front of these scouts?
Correct. That's what he told me.
Okay.
At USC Pro Day.
Talking with Scott Schrader, publisher, head analyst of TrojanInsider.com. Every time I read a write-up about Ronald Jones, Scott, all I hear about is, well, when he gets into the NFL, there's no way that any NFL team can give him 20 carries. He can only get 10 to 12. I'm looking at his game logs. I mean, he had, I think,
he carried
the last,
more than Barkley
yeah,
did.
Yeah, 5 games of the season, Scott. He had, you know, 23 or more carries. So, you know, I'm a little taken back when I read this. If you could provide some insight, you know, why is there so much chatter about that he needs limitations on his workload?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure about that. Considering what he did this past season, I can understand if they were focused on the first couple of seasons because, you know, he was 10, 15 pounds lighter. He wasn't nearly as strong, and he was one of those guys that got tripped up easy. He was knocked down easy. His yards after carry was almost nothing. But when Dylan McCullough came in as a running backs coach from Indiana, what his impact on Ronald Jones was just enormous. And so the weight gain, and the yards after carry and the process and the technique that's needed in order to permit yourself to have that. So, you know, he had those amount of carries and Dylan McCullough doesn't like to wear out his running back. So, you know, he's not going to be a guy who's going to carry the load for an entire football game. But, yeah, as far as being limited to, you know, 10 carries a game or something like that, I'm not quite sure where that comes from. But I could see where they may be taking that from his previous two seasons.
Yeah, just to note the numbers, in 4 consecutive games in November and the first game in December last year, he had 27 carries, 25 carries, 28 carries, and 30 carries. So that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Scott, one other thing real quick on Jones. Who I think, by the way, in my opinion, might be the second best running back prospect in this draft. he did wasn't asked to catch the ball a lot at USC, but you watch him on film, and I watched probably six or seven of his games last year. It looks like he runs a decent route, and when the ball is thrown to him, he does catch it. Is that something else that you think he's going to really want to show to scouts when he does his workout, that he's a better receiver than the USC offense allowed him to show?
Without question. That's another topic that we talked about at USC's Pro Day. And it's a topic that, we've talked about through over the course of the season. Because quite honestly, his first couple of years, Ronald Jones, he had a hard time catching anything.
Okay.
I feel the impact of Dino McCullough, who's now the running backs coach for the Chiefs. His impact was enormous in all facets of his game. He became a much better blocker, as well as pass protection became almost a strength, whereas it was non-existent for a couple of years. So he just became a complete running back in 2017.
Scott, in terms of the other notable top prospects in this USC class, I mean, that brings us to the defensive side of the ball. Rasheem Green, who played interior on the defensive line at USC, they're projecting him to be a defensive end in the NFL. His sack certainly jumped out over the last two seasons. Can he be versatile enough, do you think, to play inside and outside on the NFL level, or is he best suited to be a defensive end?
He's a guy. That's an interesting question, coming from my perspective and looking at it, and that you see a guy who 275 pounds. He's a guy who's just in amazing shape,
right?
Physically, so adding weight won't be an issue. He kind of kept his weight purposely down during his time at USC to keep his speed, but I think he's going to be best suited for the outside. As a defensive end, but in talking to Kenichi Udazi, the defensive line coach at USC, he thinks he's exceptionally versatile and would have no problem playing either position.
The way I've heard Green described is that he's a very high-end athlete, but maybe some of his technique and things like that are raw and need a little polish. And if he had chosen to go back to school, if he added some of those technique things, he could have been a top 10 pick maybe in the 2019 draft. Do you think that's a fair description of his athletic ability as compared to, his technique and things like that that might need some refining?
Yes. Yeah, that is. That's a topic that came up right after the Cotton Bowl. In fact, I asked Kenichi Udazi about that, and he thought that it would be very beneficial for Rasheem to come back for his senior year. Not that he's making a bad to support decision by entering the NFL draft, but he thought he might be able to help himself in next year's draft. But yes, that was definitely a topic.
Another defensive player that is notable in terms of the USC class, in terms of linebacker slash edge guy, Uchenna Nwosu. He hasn't been playing football for a very long time, Scott. Sort of raw, similar maybe to, Green, who we were just talking about. What is the upside from Nwosu at the next level?
Gosh. Uchenna is a guy, as far as going to the next level, just... I always start how things came from high school. He was a guy that was under 200 pounds, undersized. He's always been that undersized guy, not strong enough. He's not going to be big enough.
Wow.
And then he got big enough. he went from a guy, and the way I put it to him, spring practice a couple of years ago, he went from a guy that I forgot was on the football team to a guy that looked like he was the best player on the football team. And going into this season, for me on defense, you could take all the guys that USC has on defense. Uchenna Nwosu was their best player. So he's a guy, he's explosive. He's got an enormous chip on his shoulder. His work ethic is incredible. So as far as going to the next level, at the very least, he could become one of the best pass rushers, in my opinion.
So it seems to me for a Giants defense that runs a 3-4, and they're looking for these athletic stand-up rushers that can maybe put their hand in the dirt in passing situations. He seems like the type of athlete in terms of build and ability that would fit into that type of scheme, right?
Absolutely. I mean, perfect. I mean, this guy, I'm telling you, somewhere down the road, this guy, we're going to be talking about Chenna Nwosu in the NFL. There's absolutely no question about it. He's just such an impressive football player. And even his ability to get in the backfield. One of the biggest plays for USC this football season was Stanford had 4th-and-1 at the goal line at the end of the game, and Nwosu got in the backfield and got the running back for a loss of a couple yards. And then USC went down and scored the game-winning touchdown. So that's the kind of stuff he does. He makes big plays. And I always go back to that chip that he has on his shoulder. He's constantly being doubted, and that fuels him.
We're talking with Scott Schrader, publisher, head analyst of TrojanInsider.com. The other thing I noticed about him from a statistical standpoint, Scott, 19 passes defensed in the last two seasons combined. You know, you talked about his upside at getting to the quarterback into the backfield. How is he in terms of dropping back in coverage? Because if he could defend passes, I would assume that maybe they were comfortable in terms of allowing him to get back into the field to maybe go after wide receivers and tight ends.
Yeah, well, the one thing that you find in the Pac-12 is that's almost a necessary part of playing defense is having the instincts and the awareness to be able to be in position to knock down those passes and that's what he has, and his ability to drop back in coverage. To me, I don't know how good he was, but sometimes that means he was probably pretty good. He didn't notice it being an issue ever.
Did most of those deflections happen near the line of scrimmage, or was he dropping and like carrying tight ends down the seam as well?
Most of it happened at the line of scrimmage.
Got it. Scott, great stuff. We really appreciate the time. Thanks so much for joining us and giving us the time. We know the other wide receiver and Ronald Jones will have their workout day later on in the spring, and we look forward to seeing it. Thanks for the insight today. We really appreciate it, and we'll talk to you down the road, all right?
Thanks a lot, Scott.
All right, thanks, guys.
That's Scott Schrader, TrojanInsider.com. Got some good insight there, I think, on those four guys, and I think both Green and Nwosu, I think Nwosu specifically based on scheme, could be a day two guy to put into your little microscope and say, maybe he might fit with what the Giants are trying to do.
Yeah, I think based on his description, John, I mean, the fact that he has that versatility and you're thinking about how Betcher may utilize those linebacker-esque type of players, I mean, he may be an intriguing name to consider once the Giants get into the mid to late rounds. And, you know, Green is also, I think, somebody with upside who has that rawness that, you know, we'll see whether or not his skill set can translate over to the NFL.
All right, I want to get to the stuff from the rules at the NFL meetings, Dave Gettleman and John Mara yesterday, but we do have a call on Sam Darnold, and considering we just did a lot of stuff on USC, I want to get to that first. Let's go to line four, Matt. Jay in England, he joins us first on Big Blue Kickoff. What's up, Jay?
Hey, what's up? What's going on, guys?
What's up, man?
All right, so I've been watching Sam Darnold. I've been watching a lot of his tape. And the big thing that stands out with him, what scares me with him, is his delivery, right? He has that weird, wind-up, elongated release that, you know, he can get away with it at the collegiate level. But in the NFL, you know, those guys are faster. They're smarter. They can see that from a mile away. And
hey, Jay, I have a question. Jay, do you think Russell Wilson's delivery is a problem in the NFL? Because Darnold's is noticeably quicker than his.
Yeah, but Russell Wilson also has the ability to move around in the pocket and create
plays.
So does Sam Darnold. Sam Darnold's an excellent athlete. He's maybe not the athlete Russell Wilson is, but he can certainly move. Oh, absolutely,
yeah,
Darnold can
mobile.
Move. Dude, he had a 45-yard run last year.
So, all right, so fine. So here's my thing. So if you look at his pro day, right, he cleaned it up pretty well, right?
Mm-hmm.
He opted out of going to throw at the combine.
Now, Jay, real quick, I just want to point something else out. His quarterback coach at his pro day at USC said, we decided that his throwing motion was quick enough that we weren't going to touch that. They talked about ball protection and footwork, but they're not touching his release. And I happen to agree with them. I don't think his release is an issue. I think other stuff needs to be cleaned up, but the release isn't anything that they're touching in their workout. So go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted you. Finish up.
No, that's fine. I like these points. So, all right, so comparing his tape to his pro day, would you say his release looked different?
No.
You don't think so? I thought it looked completely different.
I didn't.
I don't think there was a drastic change. I think, obviously, from what Jordan Palmer emphasized, he's trying to think about how he secures the football once it snapped, which was an issue because he always usually had one hand on the football, and those were the types of things that he was working on, as well as his footwork. I mean, I had Jordan Palmer on another show that I do for Sirius, and that's what he said was the main thing that he was tinkering with. He didn't say anything about how he was telling Sam Darnold, your throwing motion is completely out of whack.
No, he went out of his
way to drastically change that.
They interviewed Palmer on NFL Network at Darnold's pro day, and he went out of his way to say that we did not touch his release and we're not trying to change the way he throws the football. The other stuff, yes, but Palmer said they're literally not trying to change that.
Okay. So with the second overall pick in this draft, are you guys comfortable with Sam Darnold in cold weather in New York throwing with that motion in the NFL?
Yes.
I mean, Russell Wilson's thrown in cold weather too.
Yeah, I am absolutely, Jay. He is a very good hand size. He can spin the football. He's got a really good arm. Again, I've seen him shorten that motion up when he has to. Usually you only see the really wider motion when he's trying to throw really far downfield. There are reasons not to draft Sam Darnold, and there are legitimate reasons not to draft Sam Darnold. I do not believe his release is one of them.
All right, fair enough. That's all I wanted to ask you.
Yeah, great stuff, Jay. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Good stuff. And look, those are legitimate questions because I've heard that brought up by other people too about his release, but I don't think that's something that people in the league are really that concerned with. I think they're concerned with, you know, throwing it into traffic with the interceptions.
I mean, that's what I would be more concerned
holding
with.
Holding on to the football with the fumbles and only having played 2 years. I mean, he doesn't have a ton of experience, and I think – you know, those are the types of things, and maybe some of the stuff with his footwork, like stepping in the bucket, he gets inaccurate. I think those are the things scouts get a little worried about. You know, there might be a couple of people that worried about the motion, but my personal opinion, and these other guys know a lot more about this technical quarterback stuff than I do, that does not concern me that much.
And just for clarification, Palmer was working more with Josh Allen on changing his throw and his decision-making, much more so than Darnold. Because, you know, I think what confuses people, John, is Palmer's not just working with Darnold. He's also the quarterback's coach of Josh Allen. And, by the way, Kyle Allen, too, who's coming out of Houston.
And, by the way, Allen, the one thing I remember Palmer said he worked on with Josh Allen is that Allen tended to, in college, to have really bad feet. His feet weren't set right, and he would quote-unquote overstride on his passes, which would put him off balance, and that would lead to some of his accuracy problems.
Yeah.
And from what I've heard Palmer say, and you mentioned you had him on a show, that's the main thing he's working with on Allen in terms of trying to get him more accurate heading into the next level.
Yeah, because that impacted some of his intermediate throws.
Oh, absolutely.
Too, not just the deep holes we're talking about. So that's why they had to reconstruct that.
No question about it. All right, before we get to the calls, and Christian, Charlie, I see you on the line. Real quick, Lance, on the rules. I want to get to this real quick, and then we'll take the calls on that, the Giants, anything else you want to talk about.
Well, the fact that Charlie's on the line, we could spend an extra 15 minutes, I think, on the rules. Nobody's in a hurry to hear from him.
And I'm sure Charlie wants to continue our debate on Twitter from last night and this morning, which will be fun.
Lovely.
He already put me in more of an annoyed mood.
Well, he's perfected that craft.
Yeah, he has, very well. The rules. I think the catch rule will be a good change in that I believe that more plays that fans logically think should be a catch will be ruled a catch, and I think that'll make a lot of people happy. But, and this will be in Fact or Fiction on Giants.com later in the week, this is not going to eliminate controversy when it comes to catches in the NFL. You're still going to have and I will give you what the new rule is very quickly because I did copy and paste it. This is the very brief new rules that define a catch. Control the ball, 2 feet down or another body part, and a football move, such as a third step, reaching or extending for the line to gain, or the ability to perform such an act. All right, so first of all, what's the ability to perform such an act? That is left to a lot of interpretation.
It's a gray area.
What is control? How much does a ball have to move for something to be considered no control? If you start a football move and then you lose the ball, is it incomplete? Or do you have to finish your football move for it to be a control on the third step? So I think there are a lot of issues here that are still going to be controversial. And I think you can get controversial here now in terms of incomplete pass or fumble. There's guys who lose the football on a bang-bang play. Is it a fumble or is it an incomplete pass? So there's going to be no lack of controversy. It'll just be a different type of controversy.
Yeah, especially if there's no contact on that catch and then the ball is lost. Because remember, if you're touched and then you lose the ball, you know, that's different than obviously if you're not contacted in terms of the rules. I agree with you. You're still going to have controversy. You're still going to have debate. If everybody thinks that everything's going to go away because they simplified, quote-unquote, the rules and regulations, I think that's a fairy tale.
There's still judgment here. There's still judgment on the hands of the refs.
There always is
going to
be judgment. That's what being an official is. Mm-hmm. It's applying the language of the law to what you're seeing with your own two eyes. And you hope that it's consistent time and time again, but there's obviously going to be that gray area. What they've removed, John, is they've removed surviving the ground. Now, personally, I never had a problem with the rule. I like the aspect of surviving the ground because I think there is a sense of completeness as you're going down to survive that to prove that you caught the football. However, they're removing that. To answer your question, John, I think they've been focusing a lot on the Dez Bryant and the Jesse James plays. So if you look at the Dez Bryant play, John, when they threw it to him down the left sideline in that playoff game against Green Bay, he clearly caught the ball, secured it with two hands. He took about two steps, and then as he went to the ground, the ball moved. So
that came out of his hand completely.
Correct. Came out of his hand. So the point is now, Dez, he has both hands on the football. He takes two steps. The process is done, according to the NFL.
Well, takes two steps and reaches the ball out. Remember, you need the third component there. You need three steps or a football move.
Correct. But what he did completed what they're looking for.
That would constitute control.
In terms of that.
Same for Jesse James,
correct,
who took out two
Jesse
steps
James.
Down and then reached
and
the
then,
ball.
And then reached out. And then the process of him hitting the ground obviously led to the ball moving and being ruled incomplete. So they're taking away the ground aspect. That's essentially what's been removed from the equation.
And since both those players would have broken the plane of the goal line. Well, actually, you know what? Did Dez break the plane of the goal line?
No, Dez was short, I believe.
So would that have been a fumble then if he wasn't contacted by the defender? Was he contacted by the defender when he had control? He might have been.
I could bring the play up.
He might
have
been.
I think he was touched.
Okay.
As he went down.
Got it.
Whereas,
but the bottom line is that they both would have demonstrated control based on the new rule when they broke the plane. Therefore, even though they lose it after they hit the ground in the end zone, it's a touchdown.
Well, and it's the same thing with the Sterling Shepard play against the Philadelphia Eagles.
And that would
Eagles.
Have been considered a touchdown as
that
well.
That would be a touchdown now under the new rules because he caught the ball. He obviously was in the process of going to the ground, but he took enough
he
of a football move
he took three
after
steps.
That it's done. And then it doesn't matter what happens after you're going to the ground. So that's what I said. The way that fans need to view it is remove the going to the ground, surviving the ground. It's
out.
A matter of, okay, once the ball's in your hands, did you do enough immediately after that to then say, okay, enough was done to complete the game?
The football move is back.
Yeah,
it was taken out of the rule, and the football move is back.
The terminology is back, yes.
All right, the exactly. other rule that they added in, playing rule Article 8, this is off the Twitter account of Brian McCarthy, who's one of the NFL PR guys out there who does a great job. It is a foul if a player lowers his head to initiate and make contact with his helmet against an opponent. The player may be disqualified. Applies to any player anywhere on the field. The player may be disqualified. This is obviously going to require a lot more massaging, a lot more detail, because players hit each other with their helmets every single play in the National Football League at the line of scrimmage and goal line plays. The running back lowers his shoulder and hits guys in the head with his helmet on running plays. So there's and there's also the question of intent here as well. How do you judge intent? And college has a targeting rule. This seems to be kind of what this is based upon. And I think there's going to have to be a lot more detail and nuance to this than the simple language that we've seen so far.
Well, because right now, as I'm interpreting it, John, to me it's so generic
that
anybody that lowers their helmet, period, it's a flag.
There should be three flags on every play.
And I think it's going to be very difficult for these players to adjust, both on the defensive and offensive side of the ball. Absolutely. I mean, the one player that comes to mind is when Marshawn Lynch was with the Seahawks. You know, every time he would get the football, get out to open space, he'd pound through defenders. He'd immediately lean in with his helmet. So immediately, you know, we're not talking about, this is what needs to be clarified. This is no longer just the crown of the helmet, you know, which was a big part of the rule. This is, period, lowering the helmet. So you're talking about a vast area now of contact.
And to make contact with his opponent, not with his opponent's head.
Yeah, just period.
Any part
That's
of his
saying.
Opponent.
The minute the head goes down, I think you're opening yourself up for a flag.
Which is why I think we're going to see a whole lot more about this. And they said the NFL is still working on the rule. The competition committee's working on it to get the targeting thing more specific. But I think this will be a tricky thing for the NFL to figure out, because it's not – college struggles with the rule too. I mean, you've seen these replay challenges, Lance, on these Saturday games, and they're really important because you can get tossed from a game in college, and you lose your best player in the first quarter because of a bang-bang play. There might not be even intent, but because a guy comes down at the wrong angle or the offensive player moves at the wrong time, the safety's helmet happens to hit the other guy's helmet, even if there's no intent, you can still get tossed out of a game. So this is a very, very tricky thing. And look, I get why the NFL's doing it, okay? Safety is very important. It's a big part of trying to make this game future-proof and have it continue for a long time. And they're going to do whatever they can to promote player safety for the younger generations, the older generation, former players, all that stuff. They want it a safer game. But a lot of more detail is going to come out about this because it can't be this generic.
No, they're certainly going to have to clarify it, provide more detailed language because, I mean, think about this, John. In the span of, what, a few plays on a drive, you could have two, three consecutive plays where a guy lowers his helmet 15 yards, 15 yards, 15 yards. It's going to take nothing to get down the field.
Right.
And I don't think they want football to become of that.
And I don't think they want people going for legs either on tackles and tearing ACLs. Because players get mad about that too. Okay, so you can't go high, you can't go low. What are you supposed to do?
Where are you going to hit him?
And I want to give you two quotes from Rich McKay, who's the executive of the competition committee.
He's the chairman.
For us, this is a pretty significant change. This one technique, we saw so many hits when a player lowered his head and delivered a hit and either hurt himself or the player he was hitting. We saw that with Nat Burhe last year. He would deliver those hits and give himself a concussion. It was time for a change of this magnitude. This has very little requirement to it. This is simply if you lower your head to initiate contact and you make contact with an opponent, it's a foul. So we're going to have to get more detail, like we said a million times. One more quote from him. I think the impetus was the research. Because the more we saw the concussion plays and the more there was a common technique, it became more apparent that we needed to get out of situationally saying, well, if a player is targeted or if a defensive player is in the air, we need to get to the technique that can protect the person doing the hitting as well. And that includes someone like Ryan Shazier, who obviously got hurt on a play last year.
And listen, I understand that there's going to be immediate reaction to that. You never want to see a player be put in that type of situation. But, you know, this, just think about this, John. This now changes how coaches, to that quote, are going to have to now start teaching their players in terms of, you know, implementing strategy, how you go about positioning yourself to make a tackle. You know, it's almost like you need to reprogram
in some ways
all of your players.
Now, you would think maybe some of the younger kids coming from college would deal with this already. Maybe it's already pre-programmed in.
But
and
a
I think
15-year veteran or a 10-year veteran
hard.
Who
Even a
is
six-year
used to
veteran.
Doing it yeah, one yeah. way, now all of a sudden has to sing a different tune.
And I'm not sure if you've seen the videos, but the Seahawks teach more of a rugby-style tackling technique where you kind of put your shoulder across the guy's midsection and you kind of turn and spin him to the ground. That's how the Seahawks teach tackling. I think that's something you might see a little bit more prevalent around the league now. But look, it's something that the league knows it has to fix moving forward. Concussions can, you know, obviously have a bigger impact than any other type of injury, depending on the player, and they're doing their best to make the game as safe as possible. The last thing we'll mention is Dave Gettleman did speak yesterday at the end of the show, and then John Mara had two quotes to Paul Schwartz at the end of the day. John Mara's quotes could not have been more clear. In that they are not shopping Odell Beckham Jr. They want Odell Beckham Jr., a member of the team and a member of the Giants, but it is a two-way street. The Giants cannot guarantee that. Odell Beckham Jr. must sign a contract. There are never any guarantees in life, but the team wants him here, and they'll do what they can to make sure he's here for long term. And I think that keeps it pretty simple.
Quote, he's not on the block, end quote. This is directly from John Mara to the New York Post. And then he continues on to say, is that going to stop clubs from possibly calling us? No, but he's not on the block. We're not shopping him. End quote. So I think that at least hopefully puts perhaps some of the speculation to rest. I know it's not because everybody's still going to want to come up with their various trade scenarios. But John Mara and Dave Gettleman, between both of their comments,
right.
I think they at least tried to quell some of the speculation.
The other thing that I thought was significant from Dave Gettleman, and these are quotes that Tom Reich had in his story yesterday, talking about how he's not going to put his thumb on the scales when it comes to a certain position. We've talked a lot about positional value on the show. And look, you don't know if what Dave Gettleman's doing is a smokescreen or what, but based on what he said at the owners' meetings, what he said at the combine, it doesn't appear that positional value is something that he's very concerned with. Now, That could be posturing. Who knows?
Of course.
But he basically said that, look, the quarterback has – he basically said if we're picking the quarterback, he's going to have to be a higher-graded player than the other players available. You're not going to take a quarterback with a 90 grade over a running back with a 95 grade. That's basically what he said. Whether or not that's how it plays out, we'll have to wait and see. But that's the inference that he made yesterday in the quotes he gave to the media, that position value is not something that's going to tilt the scales when they get in the draft room. They're going to pick the best player, and they're going to be very happy to pick the best player, and it's not even going to be hard for them. Is basically what he said.
Well, and listen, whether it's a smokescreen or not, I think that's a wise philosophy. And let's face it, it's a philosophy that even Jerry Reese was preaching a lot too, when they always said best player available. So I don't necessarily think it's that different from how most general managers and most executives look at the draft. You always want to maximize the value of the pick. And that's what you and I have been talking about on a lot of these shows when everybody calls up John and wants to start thinking about moving down. At the end of the day, if Dave Gettleman views the prospects on the board when the Giants are on the clock at number two, regardless of position, if there's somebody he believes is going to be a solid player to build the franchise around, you take that player at number two and you don't think twice about it.
And more than solid. Again, he said it again the other day, the chance to be putting on the gold jacket in Canton one day.
Correct.
Is this guy not only worth a second overall pick this year, is this a guy you would be comfortable picking second overall in any draft? It was something else he reiterated yesterday. So those are the things I think that you kind of keep an eye on. He was very effusive in his praise for Saquon Barkley. Why wouldn't you be? He's an excellent prospect. He was effusive in his praise for Bradley Chubb. So, look, I think all the options are open right now. It would appear, though, at least to me, simply based on what Gettleman has said, a quarterback might be a little bit less likely, but who knows? Maybe when all is said and done, they have Sam Darnold graded the highest player in the draft, or Josh Allen, or Josh Rosen, whoever it might be. Maybe they do. I don't know. But the bottom line is that based on what Dave Gettleman has said, and again, I don't know what's going to happen when they put the names up on the board in that draft room, the positional value doesn't seem like it's going to be something that weighs a quarterback in favor of, say, a running back.
And even when Pat Shurmur addressed the quarterback situation, which I'm sure you addressed on yesterday's show because he spoke earlier in the day, you know, he was pressed upon, well, where does Davis Webb compare to the rest of these quarterbacks? And he said, I went back and I looked at Davis Webb's college film because that's the only comparison you could utilize at this point,
right,
since there is no regular season NFL tape for Davis Webb. And that's what they're going to use, I'm sure, to determine, do they think they have enough upside currently on the roster, John, or does taking a quarterback, perhaps a number two, provide even more upside or better chances to get the successor for Eli Manning?
And he said Webb was rated highly. You know, what does highly mean? Does highly mean a day two pick? Does highly mean a day one pick? That's something Pat Shurmur wouldn't answer if you asked him.
Yeah.
Highly's a very simple, broad phrase for a reason, and he used it for a reason. So, again, those are all things you take a look at moving forward, and I think those are the significant things that Dave Gettleman said. He also basically said that Barkley will be at the Giants facility for a private workout at some point in a day.
Which is understandable.
Yes. I imagine they'll do that for most of the guys
yes,
we've talked about
indeed,
that they might select with the second overall pick. You want to make sure you get that one right. You don't want to screw up that second overall pick in the draft.
Got to do your homework.
Let's get to the calls at 201-939-4513. Christian in New York has been on hold and winning the longest. He'll be up first. Hi, Christian.
Hey, guys.
What's up?
I'm starting to really narrow what I personally as a fan want at number two. And it's driving all of us fans crazy because we're not used to this at all. Like, this is such a wider, like, spectrum of just options than we have ever, than most of us have ever experienced. And Lance, I know people drive you crazy with the win now versus rebuilding thing. And I honestly think teams don't do anything very drastic with those situations. Like no one's not trying to win ever, but
well,
like,
Christian,
on purpose,
I will say this: I do not believe the Browns did everything possible to try to win the last 2 years. They didn't spend salary cap money. They traded down in the draft to acquire picks in future years. So I do think there are teams that from time to time will not do everything they possibly can to win now to help you in future seasons. And I think, frankly, sometimes that might be the right thing to do. But I think the other side of it is the most important thing. Very few teams say, to hell with the future, I'm putting all my assets into 1 year, and unless maybe you have a franchise quarterback that's 42 and you know he's going to retire after the year, then maybe you do something like that, but I don't think that's something teams very often do.
Well, I think teams have expectations that are realistic. To me, having expectations that are realistic is different than not wanting to win, meaning Cleveland's not going into the season thinking we're definitely going to make the playoffs, we're going to compete for a Super Bowl. Remember, they're also, their previous regime was from the Moneyball philosophy, which was very much into analytics, you know, investing in young guys who have upside.
Maximizing assets.
Correct, their mathematical equations, much more so than right now with John Dorsey, guys that have experience in the front office evaluating talent and looking at guys for what they're worth.
But to your point, I think even for Sashi Brown last year, when his team lined up every Sunday, he wanted his team to win the game.
Yeah, and that's my bigger point. My point is, you don't go into a season saying, we want to win two games. Why do we want to win two games, John? So we could get the second overall pick in the NFL draft. This is not – we live in a society today where everybody is fascinated, and the guy to my right can relate to this because he writes about it, this NBA tanking.
Yeah, correct.
Okay, whole narrative. So everybody's now applying it, John, to the National Football League. There is no such thing as tanking in the National Football League. You're not telling a player to go out there and not try hard.
And Lance,
it's just not happening.
Quite frankly, there's not even really, except for a few exceptions, there's not really tanking in the NBA either. Not for players and coaches, at least. Players and coaches try to win every single game they're involved in.
Yeah.
Now, the front office might decide not to play certain guys,
well,
and the front office might try to sit guys out or do things like that so the team loses. But coaches and players, once you're on the field, guess what? You're trying to win the game or on the court. Anyway, Christian, go ahead. We kind of hijacked your call there for a second. Sorry about that.
No, that's all right. But I think a good example of, like, the modern level of a win-now act would be the trade for Jay Ajayi in the fourth round this year, because it's not something that can make or break your team. I mean, it's really just a mid-round pick, but it was for a player that's going to be good right now, and they didn't use anything, like, too high on him.
Well, right, but he's also a young player that they control. So it's like, to your point, it's not like they traded a first-round pick for Adrian Peterson, who was 32 and is going to be done in a year.
And they also did that at the trade deadline, too. You talk about the Jay Ajayi trade?
Is
that with the, which the Eagles did, which was at the trade deadline. And it was a guy that was still on a rookie contract, so it wasn't an enormous amount of money that they figured they'd have to absorb in their salary.
Yeah, Christian, the teams will try to win now. My point is that teams don't throw away their future, generally, to try to win now. And like you said, the Eagles certainly didn't do that with that particular trade.
No, and remember, they also, they had lost Darren Sproles, so they figured there maybe was a need for an additional running back, and it's no different than any other team that is in the mix. They were the best team in the NFC, and they thought, hey, we're not going to part ways with a tremendous asset that's going to hurt us moving forward, and we still get a young guy in return. It makes sense. I mean, I don't think there is anything in that trade to read into that Howie Roseman was thinking short-term versus long-term by making that move.
Well, no, I'm just saying they were in such a good season already at that point that they knew that it'd probably be wise to really prep for the playoffs and maybe not give Clement more of a chance. But really, like,
well, he's
I just
a different running back
that,
than Clement. He's a completely different running back than what Jay Ajayi brings to the table, too. I think their philosophy was, we want another style runner
that
we can
overall
bring into the mix.
Christian, what's your overall point here? Where are you going with this?
Yeah, really, I'm just trying to say that teams, not all teams really go by the win-now versus rebuild thing, but there are win-now versus rebuild acts that happen once in a while, like in certain situations.
Well, of course.
But Jay Ajayi example is not one that I would use to sell your point, I'll tell you that. I mean, I think that's just a typical trade that a team does when they lose a player to injury, and I think it helps them short-term and long-term.
Now, I'll say this, Christian, for example. And I'll use the Giants as an example. This year, the Giants traded future draft picks for Alec Ogletree. That's a move that's designed to win now, right? Well, just a month later, they traded a good player for a future draft pick, which some people will consider is a win-later move. So what does that tell you? It tells you that you worry about your future and your present at the same time, and you can make moves that accomplish both those goals within weeks of one another.
Well, but to your point, John, Ogletree's 26 years old. I mean, I don't think that's just a win now. I think that's also win perhaps
but the point is,
next 4 or 5 years,
you're giving up future assets for a guy that can help you right away.
Well, and I get that, but my philosophy is what you're going to get out of a fourth and a sixth rounder this year is unlikely that it's going to equate to what Ogletree gives you immediately.
Of course.
And the fact that he's 26 26. If he was 30, to me, that's by far more lopsided towards win now.
Yeah, of course.
26 keeps the window open way beyond.
And he's also under a long-term deal, too.
Yeah.
Well, basically, like, my overall point is that I want to stay, like, somewhere in the middle of the two and not do anything too drastic. And I don't think, because what I want is I either want to just have them draft either Sam Darnold or Josh Rosen if they don't get, like, a absolute boatload of picks from somebody. Really just because I think that he, within 1 or 2 years, one of those guys will honestly probably be better than Eli at that point.
Christian, thanks for the call, and you might be right. I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, I'm going to try to win now with Eli, but at the same time, I'm going to use this draft pick to pick the player that's going to be the bridge for your next franchise quarterback. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, and if you're sold on one of the quarterbacks, I think that's exactly what you should do. Whether or not the Giants are sold on one of these quarterbacks remains to be seen.
Listen, when they had Kurt Warner just here real quickly, I mean, nobody necessarily, I think, thought, John, that Kurt Warner would be removed from the starter's job and Eli would be thrown into the mix so quickly as it happened. I think most people thought Kurt would probably be the quarterback for the full season. Remember, they were still very much winning early in the season.
4-5 when they made the move?
Ballpark, he started, Eli's first start was against the Falcons. So
let me look that up, actually.
That was,
okay.
I want to say, early November, I believe, was when he made his first start. It may have been late October. Not exactly sure.
I think the team was one game over 500 when they made that.
I think they were 5-4, if memory serves me correct, in that ballpark. So, you know, all of a sudden you make a draft pick that is for the future, but then things change. Now, I'm not indicating that Eli's going to get benched at any point this season. That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah, 5-4, you're right.
5-4, okay. Well, the point I'm making is that sometimes you have the veteran quarterback on the roster, your short term seems to be intact, but at the same time, there's upside with a quarterback that's available that you want to grab him now because you think he'll build that bridge and put you in position where you're consistent at that one position, which is the most important position in the NFL. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that philosophy where it admits to the fan base that this is now a win-later move. I don't see it that way. I think it's just a big picture perspective that you're applying to your team.
You're still going to go out every Sunday and try to win football games
exactly.
And make the playoffs. And by the way, you can still do that if you draft a quarterback.
Of
number
course,
one. You have a chance to make a playoff run.
Eli Manning can still run the quarterback position.
Correct.
The last time I checked.
All right, let's go to Charlie. We're short on time, so Lance will be happy. I'm not going to play our open.
Yeah, great news.
And I'll go ahead, Charlie. Make your point.
And here we go. I was just going to say, you know, that would have been a touchdown for Odell in that Patriot game in 2016. Would have changed that game when they called it incomplete because
well,
he went out
hold
of bounds.
On. He didn't make a football. Did he make a football move on that, John?
I don't remember the play.
Yeah,
I don't remember.
No, he's talking about the Patriots game, which is when he's right across the goal line, catches the ball, and then the ball drops out. Immediately.
I'll have to check
that.
We'll have to look at
that. Charlie, I would not run with this narrative that under the new rule would definitely be a touchdown.
He had two feet down and he took one step and that's the new rule. So new rule takes all that kind of stuff out. All those things that weren't touchdowns were touchdowns. And that was the whole point of changing the rule. I think it's simple. People look at a catch and say, yeah, he caught it. Doesn't matter if he falls out of bounds 10 yards and drops the ball. It's still a catch. So I think it's great.
See, I'm bringing up the play right now.
Okay.
I'll let John look at it too.
He did not take a third step. Oh, no, that play?
That play.
I was looking at a different one.
Oh, you're looking at a different one. No, I think you may be.
Oh, no, this might be the same.
That may be you have the slow motion one.
Let me see.
Look to the naked eye here.
One, two.
I'm telling you, that to me is very
close.
That's
very close, Charlie. Honestly, I would have to see a slower replay of it. Let me see.
Yeah.
I got a slow replay here, Lance, right here. Take a look. We got catch, 1 foot, 2 foot, ball out. Nope, I do not believe that's a football move.
I think that's way too close to 100%.
And by the way,
under the new rules,
that's why there's still going to be controversy with the new catch rule because this is still too close to call.
Yep.
So
look,
but didn't they say that if you're in the end zone, it's different?
Nope, end zone. And folks, and I always yell at the Tino about
this.
Rule in the field of play in the end zone
same.
Is exactly the same.
There are no two rules.
It's exactly the same.
No. We're going to use you as the guinea pig, Charlie. We're going to use you as the guinea pig.
The line, and then he drops it. It's still a friggin'
because
touchdown,
the running back has possession of the ball. The receiver doesn't have possession of the ball yet. That's why it's different.
Charlie. Runners,
right,
runners.
We'll see.
No, no, Charlie.
I'll
let you continue. But in all seriousness, sure. Runners and receivers operate on complete opposite ends of the spectrum in the NFL. I don't know why everyone bundles them together.
And it's because the running back has possession of the football.
Correct.
The receiver does not have possession of the football for it to be a touchdown until he satisfies the rule of making a catch. Now,
exactly.
Make your point on Beckham,
yes.
Charlie, because I'm sure that's why you really called.
Oh boy.
All right. This is what I have to say about this.
Yes, sir.
You know, Gettleman wouldn't even answer the question when Kim Jones was asking. But Myra and everybody has created this.
Myra. You believe this? His credibility gets thrown out the window every second.
What? I think that was his New England accent that got him that time.
Well, I don't know. I'm still going to call him out for that. But anyway, continue. Yes.
Mayra, we want to call him Mayra, Myra, Tish. It doesn't matter. It's the ownership. Right. They created this mess.
How was that?
All they had to say is, like, you know something? Our goal is to sign Beckham for life.
That's what he said.
We want him a Giant for life, and we're going to start negotiating now.
John Mara has said he wants Beckham.
And period.
Charlie.
If anybody calls us, we're not going to take the call.
Charlie, time out. John Mara has said multiple times, before even this week, I think he said it at the end of last season, that he wants Odell Beckham Jr. to be a Giant for life. Steve Tisch said they're in the very early parts of negotiation.
Said,
so those just achieved the two things you asked for.
Yeah.
But he opened up the door because they wouldn't say, like, well, we're still taking calls.
Well, but Charlie, let me ask you this, Charlie.
That's ridiculous.
You have to pick up the phone. You don't know what they're calling about.
But Charlie, even if your interpretation is on base, okay?
Yep.
Who is it opening the door for? What I love is the overreaction to this is the media speculation and the fan speculation. The reality of the situation is Odell Beckham is still under contract. He's a New York Giant. Who's it opening the door for? That's what I don't understand. It's opening the door for speculation. So you're going to tell me that people can't sleep well at night because there's a lot of speculation. There is speculation about NFL football players
it's
on every team every day
the
of the year.
They don't want to pay him that amount of money. They don't value Beckham or the wide receiver position for that amount of money.
Charlie.
And that's fine. Just
Charlie,
come out and say
I
that.
Have a simple question for you. How do you know what Odell Beckham requires to sign a long-term contract today? How do you know what he wants? And how do you know what he's willing to accept?
We look at the market value of the other receivers
that's great.
Who got money. We look at what Odell Beckham said. He wants to be paid. So if the market value is 18 to 20 million. That's what the market value
is.
In guaranteed money, it's about 60 million guaranteed or maybe a little more.
How do you know?
That's what the market value is.
Charlie, last year.
I don't mind if the organization does not want to pay him. Just be honest. Come out and say it. We don't value that position for that amount of money.
Odell Beckham Jr. came out last year and said he wants to get paid like a quarterback, okay? How do you know? And I don't know the answer to this question either. Nobody knows the answer to this question besides the Giants front office and Odell Beckham and his representation. They don't know. We don't know, rather, what the Giants are willing to offer right now and what Odell Beckham Jr. is willing to accept. What if the Giants have offered Odell Beckham Jr. the exact contract that you just spelled out and Beckham said, no, I want a Kirk Cousins contract that's fully guaranteed? How do you know that didn't happen? How do you know that?
Is a low ball figure like 14
No, but
million.
Charlie, you're assuming things that you don't know the answer to. I don't know either. I'm comfortable saying I have no idea what the negotiation is. I don't know what the Giants have offered. I don't know what Beckham wants. I have no idea. Nobody knows, and you don't know either. So you can't draw conclusions on no information on who's doing what and who's right and who's wrong. You're literally making things up and guessing. You're making it up. Charlie, stop it. Admit to me. You're making it up. Charlie, admit to me you're making up these contract offers and what Beckham is willing to accept. You don't know.
Tell me, does he want a contract this season?
Who, Odell Beckham?
Before the season starts. Beckham.
Yeah, I'm sure he does.
I mean, I'm sure from a security standpoint.
That's number one. Okay.
So did Akeem Nicks, by the way. How'd that work out?
Do they want to give him a contract this season?
For the right price, sure.
It depends.
The right price is lowballing. That's the right price.
No, every player has a price, Charlie. Every player has a price.
Charlie.
You don't write blank checks in this league. That's not how negotiations go. If you're a GM and you go to your owner and you say, here's my negotiation strategy for this player. I'm going to give him whatever he wants. Yeah. You know what happens? You get fired.
Charlie, Le'Veon Bell, hold on. Le'Veon Bell, who was one of the best running backs in the NFL, is now being put on the franchise tag for the second straight year. Are you telling me that 2 years ago, Kevin Colbert, the GM of the Steelers, wouldn't have liked to have hammered out a long-term deal and have one less headache on his plate? I mean, to say that the team wouldn't want to lock him up long-term so that they would avoid having to go through all of this, I mean, I think that that's a stretch, but that doesn't mean that you're going to achieve it. Because both minds need to meet in the middle ground. And you're at the point where you're at the point, hold on, where he is under contract for one more year. Then you also have the franchise tag as an option beyond that. Now, I don't know what Odell Beckham's thinking. I don't know what his reps are thinking in terms of holdouts and the threats and all of this. That's just pure speculation at this point. You're running wild with the speculation when we haven't heard from any of the parties individually in terms of what the state of the negotiations are and what each side is looking at financially.
And Charlie, I want to bring up
right now,
one other thing. I want to go back to giant examples for you. I want to go back to Steve Smith and Akeem Nicks. The Giants and the player those years both wanted to bang out long-term contracts. You know what? The player wanted too much or the Giants didn't want to give him enough. However you want to look at it, that's fine. Same thing with Akeem Nicks. And here's the deal. If you're a player and you want to get your big contract before you're a free agent, you don't get your full market value. That's how it works. You get risk taken away so you get less money. If you wait to the end and you have more leverage, you get more money. That's how it works. That's how negotiation happens. Because if the Giants give any player a contract before they have to, they're taking an extra year of risk that something might happen to that player. Okay?
Well, Odell's not going to play.
And well, we don't know that either.
Well, hold on, Charlie.
Wants a headache.
Charlie, that's your assumption. But let me remind you about this. Do you remember at this time last year, okay, Odell was in California, right? John, and remember there was speculation he was going to hold out in training camp. He didn't show up to spring workouts, and everybody would say contract, contract, contract. First day of mandatory camp, who shows up? Odell Beckham. So I'm not saying that history is going to repeat itself, Charlie, but once again, you're running with assumptions when we've been through this.
Different land.
Well, you're right, because it's the final year. No, it's the final year of his contract. That's all that's different. That's all that's different.
He knows his mortality now. He wants
Charlie,
a contract.
Jarvis Landry was just traded to the Cleveland Browns. He's in the same situation as Odell Beckham. He was given the franchise tag. He has no long-term security. Is Jarvis Landry holding out from the Cleveland Browns? Is that a given? Do we know that for sure? They haven't hammered out a long-term deal. Why not run with that speculation?
Yeah, but they also know that Cleveland's going to have $100 million next year under the cap.
Okay, but the Giants, who knows what the Giants' cap is going to look like, though?
It ain't going to be $100 million.
Well, I'm not saying it is, but do you know? Do you know what the cap's going to... Once again, Charlie, I understand your hesitancy, but you're running wild with all assumptions. There's no factual evidence behind...
I'm not running wild.
Yes, you are.
But Charlie, there's no... Not one thing you said has any factual evidence behind it. That's the problem.
Period.
So Charlie, time out. So Charlie, you literally, Charlie, I want to make this clear for the fans out there. Your strategy, if you're the Giants GM, for negotiating with Odell Beckham Jr. is to give him whatever he wants.
Make it rain. That's Charlie, and make it rain.
No, I'm serious. That's my question. Charlie, you're negotiating. If you were Dave Gettleman, your negotiation strategy for Odell Beckham Jr. right now, before you even know if he's healthy, coming off season-ending ankle surgery,
he says give him a blank check.
Charlie, I'm going to ask you the question. Charlie, answer my question. Your strategy is to give him whatever he wants.
No, my strategy is this. I know what the market value is. When Evans gets $17 million, you know the market value. He's the best wide receiver in the NFL. If you want to throw Brown next to him, fine. You know it's going to be between $18 and $20 million a year. That's what you can negotiate. You can negotiate 18.5. You can negotiate 19.5. You can negotiate 20.5.
Charlie, I have a question for you.
You can find the middle in there, and it's probably going to be 18.5 or 19 million.
Charlie,
that's what you negotiate.
Charlie,
Charlie, 14 million, he walked. That's it.
I looked at Mike Evans' contract last night. Do you know what's interesting about Mike Evans' contract?
Yeah, I know. He gets out of it in 2019.
All of his guaranteed money are in the first 2 years of his contract. So if the team wants to get out after the 2019 season, they carry no risk, okay? Zero risk in that contract, okay? And do you know why they were able to structure the contract that way? Because Mike Evans signed it before he had leverage and before he was going to become a free agent.
Yeah.
And you know what? I don't know the details, but something tells me inside that Odell Beckham probably wouldn't want to sign a contract with that type of structure. Do you know why? It's a virtual 2-year contract with no long-term guarantee. What is Odell Beckham looking for, according to you? A long-term guarantee.
Much,
so you can take that Mike Evans
money?
Contract, curl
Evans
it up, and
money?
Throw it away.
How much was Evans' guaranteed money? $50 million?
I think it was about
55?
40. I think it was $40 million.
Okay.
But it was only the first 2 years.
Look, Beckham would take a 3-year deal with guaranteed money because he's only, 26? He can get another contract after that.
You know, maybe Odell should call Charlie to be his agent.
He should. I'm surprised that he hasn't signed him yet.
Charlie, we got to go.
Guaranteed money. That's it.
All right, so now you want to fully guarantee his contract then.
Well, he wants guaranteed money. I don't know if he said
Cousins
fully guaranteed.
Cousins got a fully guaranteed contract.
So now he wants to give him a fully guaranteed.
Right?
Charlie, thanks for the call. We got
to
go.
Charlie wants to give fully guaranteed contracts out to just all positions right now.
And basically his strategy is I'm going to give Odell whatever he wants.
Yeah, but executive is going to operate like
coming
that.
Coming off of a season-ending ankle injury that he's still rehabbing. It's crazy.
But the bigger picture here, John, is – Charlie's looking at it in a bubble. If I look at that draft class, Aaron Donald didn't get a long-term contract. Jarvis Landry hasn't gotten a long-term contract. Odell hasn't gotten a long-term contract. Brandon Cooks hasn't gotten a long-term contract. It's not as if the Giants are in a position, John, where everybody at his spot is signed and Beckham's out on an island. And there's the urgency of, oh, my God, what's going on? So Mike Evans is not the only one setting the market. Let's not forget about that. I'm sure if you're the Giants, you're looking at what's going to happen with Jarvis Landry and the Browns. You're at least observing, and you're also observing to see what the Patriots are going to do with Brandon Cooks. I mean, that to me is smart philosophy, so that you could see, okay, this is how these teams went about their business. This is the guarantees. This is how the contract is structured, just like you look at what you mentioned with Mike Evans' structure. You got to do that. You're not going to rush into anything.
And we have no idea what Beckham wants, and we don't know what the Giants have offered. We just don't know. And nobody knows. So how can you criticize a team and how they're handling something when you don't actually know how they're handling it?
You know,
it's crazy.
You're operating under limited information.
You're guessing.
Including John and myself. It's not as if we're in the meeting rooms
privy
to the information about what's being discussed. But you can't get overreacting to the fact that guys may threaten to hold out because, John, it's been going on for years.
And if he
That's
does,
the game of leverage.
And if he does actually hold out, then we have a different conversation.
Well, of course, the conversation will change. But once again, we dealt with this, like I said, at this point last
Correct.
Year. Yes, he had 2 years left on his contract at that point, and he wound up showing up for mandatory sessions. So until we get to that point, we're operating once again under speculation.
Right. And of course, Pat Shurmur left the conversation with Odell Beckham Jr. understanding that he thinks he's going to be here for the offseason workout program. So,
and until
folks,
they get new info, there's no point.
We need information. We don't have it, okay? Pete in Staten Island got to wait through that, so I got to make sure I get to Pete. And then we got to get to lunch. Pete, what's going on, pal? Sorry about that.
Oh, my God.
Did you enjoy that?
Did you mention Will Beatty?
No, we actually did, which was kind of disappointing that after all of that, after all was exhausted, Will Beatty didn't get a mention in all that.
Exhausted is the word. I'm exhausted.
So I want to take a nap.
I need something stronger than water after that one, I'll tell you that.
Well, I got the bottle right here. Anyway,
we'll pass it on. So.
You know, Lance, I was on with you and Paul the other day, and Paul was battling between Quentin Nelson and Chubb. And I went back to tape, and I ran into a tape in the junior season, and it actually was McGlinchey against Chubb, okay?
Oh, of course it was.
About a good, about a good half hour, 45 minutes of clip. And I just wanted to, if Paul was on today, I'll tell you what, if you go back, and I know, John, you watch a lot of film.
Yeah,
if you go back to that game, and I really wanted to talk about Quentin Nelson.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Every time he passed Chubb, on to Nelson as opposed to McGlinchey, he pancaked him. He absolutely abused him. And McGlinchey had trouble with Chubb, okay? But every time he was passed over, when he ran a loop or whatever.
A stunt? Yeah.
Done. He abused him. Abused him.
I'm not surprised that Nelson's a better player than McGlinchey.
Yes.
We knew that.
Oh, did you watch that, Mom?
No, I have not watched it yet, but it doesn't surprise me because I think Nelson's a better offensive lineman than McGlinchey is. So that it honestly doesn't surprise me.
Right. And, pretty much that's all I wanted to talk about. You know, I mean, after the Charlie call, I'm burnt out. But, I'm really high on Nelson, and I'm glad you said that Gettleman doesn't care about position, which tells me that he's thinking out of the box, that if he thinks Nelson's the pick and he's the guy, that it doesn't matter if he's a guard, if he's a water boy, it doesn't matter. He's going to take him. You know, I'm happy to hear that.
It's all about value.
We do.
Yeah, I mean,
thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks for weighing in. I mean, it comes down to value. If Nelson is a Hall of Fame-esque type of player, then he should be in the conversation at number two. The only thing I will throw out, John, is if you look at Dave Gettleman with Carolina, he never took an offensive lineman that high.
True.
So,
but things change.
Of course, things change.
He never took enough running back
roster.
High until he picked McCaffrey last year. So.
Yeah, so I mean, there's only so much you can read into that.
Right.
I'm just throwing that out as additional pieces of information for those that love to speculate further on what they're going to do with the number two overall pick. I love the fact that we're maybe taking a break from the trading down, trading to the side, trading to downward, upward in terms of the number two pick to now Odell Beckham and Charlie's philosophy on Odell Beckham.
See, now, and look, the reason I got so annoyed is because I was having this conversation with him last night, and I could not get through to him that he's making assumptions about things that I don't know about, you don't know about, and he doesn't know about. And I'm not going to sit here and talk about hypotheticals when I have no factual evidence to know what's going on. It's pointless. We might as well just like throw darts at the wall. We just don't know. We don't know.
A lot of credit that you actually exhausted all that energy interacting with him on Twitter. I give him one response, and then I cut off the conversation there.
Well,
I'm sure you went back two or three times.
I make the mistake of actually trying to logically convince somebody or something.
Yeah, trying to engage with him.
And use reason.
Right there. Yeah,
reason.
Reason should be thrown out the window when it involves Charlie. But we look forward to hearing future Charlie.
And by the way, I said there would be no show on Friday. We're going to record something tomorrow that we'll post up on Friday as a podcast. It won't be live, no calls, but we'll have a long interview with Kyle Krabs. That'll be our Friday show, and it'll carry you through the weekend. Tomorrow it's Lance and Paul. They'll talk Texas Longhorn Pro Day, Connor Williams and company, Malik Jefferson. They'll talk about those prospects tomorrow. For Lance Meadow, I'm John Schmelk. I need a nap.
Try to recover.
See you tomorrow on Giants.com, everybody. Have a good one.
Have a good one.